Hello, everybody, to the next talk. We have Mariana Valente and Rachel Leharo, and they will tell us about their work about digital rights, technology, and online gender-based violence. Have fun.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Good afternoon. I am Mariana. She is Raquel. We're both doing research on this topic in these different universities and for some time already. And during this talk, we'll be discussing the problem, of course, but then also solutions that have been appearing in the policy sphere. And before we start, we'd just like to bring some numbers to discuss the size of this problem. I think this is an issue that many of you probably have heard about, but the prevalence of this is usually a lot higher than people know of. So there's a lot of data on this, actually, but I just brought one study. That's a study from the Economist Intelligence Unit from 2021. And it asked about the prevalence of online violence against women. And when looking at large, like people in general, 38% reported personal experiences with online gender-based violence. And among the Generation Z and millennials, that's 45%. When we're looking at not just personal experiences with OGBV, that's online gender-based violence, but also community that is having witnessed also violence against other women, then the number is much higher. And one of the things that's important is that it's also different from region to region. So you see that, for example, in Europe, that prevalence is of 74%, but if you look at the Middle East, that's 98%. So it's almost everyone. Almost everyone has either gone through a personal experience or witnessed someone going through an experience of online gender-based violence. One of the conclusions of the study is that women in countries with long-standing or institutionalized gender inequality tend to experience online violence at higher rates, and that speaks to this connection between the online and the offline world, which we'll be discussing in a bit.
Yes. So I will be in charge of explaining you how is the legal framework. And first, we will talk about what we consider part of online gender-based violence, or as you will see now, technology-facilitated gender-based violence. So we wanted you, if you have your mobile phones, we wanted you to scan this and then reply with some keywords. What do you think classifies or falls within the definition of online gender-based violence? Hopefully this works.
Yes.
And hopefully this works. If not, you can just say. Okay, it works. That's good. Gendered any?
Mm-hmm. Or perhaps any violence that can be, that is gendered.
Okay. Hate speech, threats.
Sexual harassment. Insulting, yes. So to gender.
I'm waiting just in case, but I think we have a clear overview of, everything you basically said is right. Oh, there are more coming.
There's a lot
okay.
Now, yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Insults, comments, misogyny.
Pics without consent.
That's an important one. Insults due to gender, insulting women, sexist comments, discrimination, hate speech. Stalking, okay, stalking, male dominance, patriarchy, there are many. Okay, so now we will go just through them a bit. As I said, there's a big discussion on how we should refer to this phenomenon. Some people call it technology-facilitated gender-based violence, and that is actually true because there are types of violence that happen within the technological sphere of abuse, but are not necessarily connected to the online, specifically gender-based violence. And one example is demotics, for example. example, but others could be when these new cars have apps and like some people use the apps of the cars to basically track their partners or do other things as well. And this is just an example. And then many conducts that fall within the category of online gender-based violence, we will cover them briefly now, but we still wanted to have like a clear taxonomy of what falls within that and how, which are the technical words to refer to this type of conduct. As we mentioned before, as you mentioned before, online harassment could be an example. Flaming is this type of abusive way and very aggressive way of communication on text messages, for example, using capital letters or using a very aggressive tone. Then threats. Dogpiling, it's also very important to acknowledge that online violence, sometimes the victim is a target, is one person, but the perpetrators sometimes are organized and have like this malicious or organized flagging and act in a group. And in this sense, I wanted to show you this example. Cristina Fallarás is a journalist from Spain. She would launch an initiative to publicly and anonymously denounce different gender discrimination situations that women were suffering in Spain. They can just contact her and she publishes them anonymously. And at some point she realized she received so many from a particular politician from Spain working in like national level politics. And she made it public, and then the whole judicial procedure started, and so on. So the day after, or 2 days after she did that, she received so many negative attacks on her Instagram account that Meta automatically took it down. Automatically. So she didn't even have access or any way to complain and try to restore it. And this happened at the end of 2024, so not so long ago. She's a very well-known journalist and very powerful in a sense. And she got her account restored just some days after because directly Meta called her to restore her account. But this also raised concerns on what would have happened if this initiative would have been launched by someone with less influence in the country, right? Other examples are stalking and monitoring. You already covered that as well. Impersonation, which means pretending to be someone's, faking someone's identity online, basically. Then public shaming, and then doxing. This one, many people don't know about it, but it's also very common in specific like forums. They share the address or other like or job address of the survivor or the target, and this also shows the connection between the online violence and offline violence. That we shouldn't see online violence just like happening in a vacuum. It happens in real life, and this is just one of the examples where survivors can get their daily lives affected if everyone knows their addresses and people just start going to their places where they work and so on. Then cyber flashing is the technical word to refer to unsolicited sexual explicit content. And they're already countries criminalizing cyber flashing, like in the UK, and there are already people going to jail for that. Swatting is reporting fake crimes to induce law enforcement authorities to the target's home to create like mental distress and also affect them their daily life, basically. Again, we see the connection with the offline world. And then concerning image-based abuse, you also covered that, but here we wanted to cover it a bit more in detail because many people refer to that, and traditionally we used to refer to that as revenge porn. And it is important to mention that we should stop using this word, even though it's very catchy and easy, because revenge porn sets the idea that first there is something to be revenged for. In many cases, like in most of the cases, or like in all cases, there's nothing to be revenged for. And second, using the word porn creates the imaginary idea that this was consented and the conduct was not consented, and it's a bit victim blaming using this word. So then we should try to make an effort to use image-based abuse, non-consensual intimate imagery abuse, or non-consensual intimate media abuse. Again, here, with the word intimacy, it might be problematic to use it. I mean, it's okay to use it, but usually in our context, we use this word in a very Western-centric approach and sex-based approach of the definition of intimacy. And sometimes we lack on acknowledging that what might that intimacy also depends on the cultural and religious context, for example. And our laws should also protect those women whose violations are not necessarily connected to sexual abuse, but other types of intimacies that they might have. And of course, necessarily connected to that is the deepfake abuse. We'll see many examples of that as well. But I just brought from also from late 2024, I think it was in November, Telegram chat in Portugal with more than 70,000 members. And then it's interesting to compare that. We will raise that at the end of our presentation, but to compare how are these platforms proactively dealing with this content when it's actually against their terms of use. The problem of this type of groups is that Telegram, for example, usually relies on users flagging content that is wrong or illegal. But if the users willingly are part of these groups, it's difficult that someone will flag the content. So maybe the platform should take more proactive measures to actually do something about that. And in that sense, this is interesting because Telegram is currently not a very large online platform under the DSA, the Digital Service Act, which I will explain in a moment. Then we also see examples of political violence happening online, and then also defamation laws and gender disinformation used against victims or survivors of this type of violence. And then Mariana will conclude the concerns about that.
Yeah, so this is a taxonomy that, of course, has to be updated all the time because apparently the tactics change quite often. Deepfake abuse, for example, is something that wasn't talked of just a few years ago. And something that's really important when updating that and also referring to the taxonomy is that it's understanding what I already said, that this happens in a continuum. And this is important particularly because online gender-based violence tends to be undervalued in comparison to other forms of violence. And there's plenty of evidence in the past 15 years that this kind of violence has concrete real-life consequences, but also that, as I pointed to in the beginning, this happens in a context, right? So many of these actions happen because of a sexist environment, because of sexist assumptions that already exist. Something that's important as well is that for this, we, of course, chose some of the terms that are used to refer to violence, but there's a lack of harmonized language. So what you will see from country to country is that some of these terms are referred to in different ways, and that makes sometimes policymaking hard, comparison hard, or sometimes we even have problems with terms, as Raquel was referring to when we used to say revenge porn. That's something that's still a lot repeated, but it's a form of reference to an action that re-victimizes the victim very much. There's another problem with this taxonomy, and that also refers to what we're going to discuss next. That's how to face this in policy. And that's the issue that it's much easier both to define and to deal. It's the wrong way to put it. It's not easy at all. But it's more common that we'll discuss issues related with sexuality and violences related to sexuality than violences related to things that women suffer in public spaces. And there's a long conversation about that that I hope we will be able to have some time to have in the questions. But one of the reasons for that is that in most cultures, there's this expectation of discretion on the part of women and an expectation that they won't be in the public spaces. So there is a long-standing legislation referring to, for example, to domestic violence or issues related to sexual violence. That's certainly not solved. But what I mean is, in most of the countries, there's no legislation referring to online misogyny or to misogyny at large. So you see legislation referring to discrimination of many kinds, but not to misogyny. And this has to do, there are many studies talking about that, this has to do with naturalizing violence against women, and particularly naturalizing that women are not in these public spaces.
Another thing is that violence is intersectional, meaning that when you look into how this develops, it is going to be different from country to country. Inside countries, it's going to be different from population to population. That really refers to the kinds of inequalities that exist in each place. So I do a lot of research in Brazil, for example. In Brazil, race really is a hierarchizes a society, and the kind of violence that you see directed towards indigenous women or black women is not only quantitatively different, but qualitatively different. The kind of words, for example, that are used, or the kind of comparisons that are made, you can really see like that for the different groups that exist in society, it's not possible to say that there's one kind of online gender-based violence at large, but online in particular. And the last thing is that when we're talking about this taxonomy, one thing that's really hard to conceptualize is how this kind of violence affects the freedom of expression of women. And that's really important to discuss, because usually when we're talking about online gender-based violence, the first, let's say, counter-argument that appears is that of freedom of expression, but it's usually the freedom of expression to express something that might be considered violence, right? Whereas there's plenty of evidence showing that online gender-based violence pushes women outside the online space of our public life, and they have an effect on women's freedom of expression. And that's hard to measure, of course, because it's hard to establish causality. And it's also hard to bring to the public discussion, because there is, especially nowadays, such a simplistic discussion on freedom of expression put into the public discussion, particularly on platform regulation.
So going back to the legal framework, again, we have to update the question. I think we have it here, right? Okay, yeah, we can use that one. Can you see it? Let me make this. So, or we can just do orally if not, because I'm not sure.
We might try to do this just a second.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted to ask you, how do you think we can tackle online gender-based violence? And again, here, feel free to put like a keyword, an area of the law, a specific redress mechanism that you know, like anything? And hopefully it works. Education. Yeah, criminal law, civil law. Platform regulation. Platform governance, individual rights. And there are some words I don't think I can pronounce.
Discrimination. I think it's discrimination law, right?
Law of equality, online rights. But yeah. Specific rules, also DSA, someone mentioned. Yeah, no area. Yeah, perfect. I think we have enough examples, and I think you were quite right. Oops. Where is our presentation here? Yeah. Okay, this is the outdated one. But yeah, basically, most of the country, like we have measures that could, in theory, allow us to fight and tackle online gender-based violence, but you will see also the concerns with the approach. More like the countries that are regulating that somehow are having. So basically there are some countries like Spain who have in the gender-based violence law a definition of digital gender-based violence. Well, in Spain it's not yet included, but they just passed the law, so it will be included like in the following months. But it's okay, it's an approach. Then there are also, as someone said, criminal law. Criminal offenses are mostly connected to stalking and non-consensual diffusion of images. Sometimes they also lack the gender perspective because they are applied broadly, and they usually don't recognize the gender dimension of online violence, that usually it's female, no? The main victims of that. Then civil law also grants like moral damages, compensations, and protection of personality rights. So some countries are using that approach. Then through labor law also, when harassment happens in the context of the workplace, then it could be possible that some countries tackle online gender-based violence through labor law. It's not so common that they refer to it directly, but again, indirectly, it could apply to these cases. And then, of course, data protection or privacy laws. In the EU, for example, we have the right to be forgotten. I think this is also in place in Switzerland. So this could also be a way to ensure or try to grant the survivors the right to delete this information and take down content that is non-consensual. And lastly, also platform regulation. And I'm sure there are like many other ways to like tackle this. Someone mentioned education law, and actually this is very interesting because as you can see from this slide, most of the measures we are taking, like countries are adopting, are in the direction of criminalizing in a very ad hoc way, which means that, as Mariana said before, we are not having laws that are protective for the yet to exist forms of abuse. So maybe adopting these approaches of having like more a general definition would also be a nice approach. And then just about the DSA is the Digital Services Act. It's the rule book in the European Union for content moderation and for intermediary liability. And I wanted to mention that it recognizes as a systemic risk of the European Union gender-based violence, which means that very large online platforms and very large online search engines, which are those that have more than 45 monthly million average users, have to conduct risk assessments annually and have to provide information on how their services and the design of their systems, including their algorithmic systems, are affecting all of these things, but particularly also gender-based violence. Just in case you don't know which are these very large online platforms, it's those, and among those we have four adult sites, which is interesting as well. As you can see, Telegram, as far as I know, it's not yet under this. And then recently the European Commission also launched created templates for platforms to submit the transparency report, expressly asking them to disclose. I'm not sure if you can see this very, very well, but basically it's disclosing information on cyber violence against women, and it includes cyberbullying and intimidation, cyber harassment, cyber stalking, gender disinformation, illegal incitement to violence, non-consensual intimate material, like many categories. So we don't have data yet as how companies will report this type of content and what will they do about it, but it will be an interesting line of research as well to study if this type of measures, increasing transparency, is connected to a better online safety for women in those platforms or not, or this approach is not so useful and maybe we should focus more on this educational approach as well. And here are our concerns from the legal part. The anonymity of the perpetrators sometimes makes it very difficult for the victims to seek redress because they don't have any means to know who is the author, and without an author, you know, cannot like condemn anyone in criminal law, at least. And then anonymity also, at the same time, protects women. There are many studies on Wikipedia and how like female content creators usually don't show their identities as female. So it means they feel like they do that for a reason, right? So there's this debate when we mention about disclosing all like our identities online and so on, there are these two sides to be considered. Then, as we said before, sexist legal concepts. In many countries, defamation laws are used against survivors of online gender-based violence instead of against the perpetrators. And this might pose problems as well, of course. Then this connects to the educational law, someone who wrote that. That's true. We're talking all the time about criminalization, but we are at the same time criminalizing more and more conduct in a very ad hoc and specific way. But at the same time, we're seeing an increase in the abuse, online abuse, especially for specific types of conduct, such as deepfake abuse and among teenagers in particular. Another concern that we see every time a country tries to regulate online gender-based violence is that they start with a narrative on women's rights, and this narrative gets dissolved into a narrative on safety for children, which of course we fully support, but it's not necessarily the same and the dynamics can work differently. So it's also important to have a debate for women's safety online as well. And then this, I have mentioned it several times, but I just wanted to mention that there are already many scholars like Claire McLean or Olga Jaras in the UK who are pushing for a more general offense and criminal offense called, for example, intimate intrusions, or it can have any name, but a general offense that can include forms of abuse that don't exist yet. So we make sure that victims are protected anytime, and we don't create indirectly this hierarchy of harms where there are harms that are also illegal, so these victims get better protection, and then there are harms who are, everyone knows they are harmful, but since they are not yet included in the law, we don't have any way to actually have a redress mechanism for them. And then another concern is a lack of effective enforcement. Sometimes due to the lack of specialized training for public officials. Sometimes it's a lack of proactive collaboration on behalf of platforms. And in general, at least in Spain, there's a problem with certifying online evidence. And here, there's something I wanted to say. In the same way that sexual violence survivors feel the need to have shower after they have experienced sexual abuse, victims and survivors of online gender-based violence feel the need to delete all the content, like automatically. And we don't have enough awareness-raising campaigns I don't want to be like, it's not on them, of course, but like we all as society need to be aware that without keeping the evidence, that these cases are, like, you cannot prosecute them, you know, if you don't have the evidences. So first thing would be for like survivors to keep the evidences, but then for police officers not to recommend them to delete the evidences and just don't take them seriously and say, just leave the online environment, just delete your Instagram account. That won't solve the problem in most of the cases. And you create like a cultural awareness that this is an important issue. And then there are some literacy measures that we can all have as society that could help a bit in the fight, or at least tackling it or condemning the perpetrators. And then I will let Mariana with the terms of service.
Terms of service, of course. We have been focusing very much on the role of the law and the state. But of course, when we're talking about online platforms, their terms of service are basically the law that applies immediately to their space. And I think one thing that's really important to consider, that relates to gender-based violence, but also to other conducts and other kinds of content online, is how these things interact, right? So you have the realm of the illegal, the realm of terms of service violation, and content that may contribute to sexism or violence. And there is some intersection in all of them, but there are parts that are not intersecting, right? So, of course, there are conducts that are illegal, and if they're illegal in a country, they are not permitted on platforms, but if you look at the platform's terms of service, they may not be prohibited per se. Right, and then there will be, of course, a conflict between these terms of service, which are self-regulation, and the state regulation, and that might be brought to courts. You may also have content that violates terms of service but doesn't violate the law. That's the case, for example, of certain kinds of nudity. In many countries, certain kinds of nudity are allowed in the media, for example, but they might not be allowed in some of these platforms. So, for example, you have a very strict policy regarding nudity in Meta's platforms. That's more, they're stricter than in many other, in many countries. And that's part of like these terms of service violation that's not intersecting with illegal. And then, of course, you might have conduct that contributes to sexism or violence, but it's neither illegal nor does it violate terms of service. One could argue that they should be made illegal or they should be made a violation to the terms of service or not. But here we're talking basically of content that probably won't be taken down. It might be that it even shouldn't be taken down because of reasons of like debate and discussion, but they may anyway contribute to sexism or violence. And of course, this interaction will be different depending on the platform we're speaking of and on the law that we're speaking of. There's one thing when we look at the terms of service, and here I'm referring to research that my organization in Brazil has done on the major platforms in 2021. Twitter was still Twitter at the time. What we saw looking at all those terms of service was that usually they don't recognize misogyny per se. Instead, they look at hate speech and characteristics such as gender. So for most of them, it's the same to say, I hate men and I hate women. So there's no consideration of power relations there. It's the category that's protected, and that works for all the other categories. Another thing is that transparency reports mostly don't break down on gender. So one of the things we're going to have to see is the impact of the DSA transparency reports that Raquel was referring to. Another thing is that platforms mostly, there are some exceptions, we're going to speak of them, don't develop common actions like they do with child sexual image abuse. Regarding child exploitation, there's a lot of cooperation between the platforms. There's even a common database that's used by all of them. But when it comes to online gender-based violence, that mostly doesn't happen except for some very specific initiatives. And then, of course, we have to refer to this. There's a trend that was inaugurated by X and was deepened by Meta this year, which is the trend of moderating less content. And also not just changing their terms of service so that certain things that used to be violations referring to online gender-based violence are not anymore, but also that they're not using algorithmic filters anymore to most of these content, except for what's considered the most harmful of them all. And that's a very complicated discussion because these filters for sure weren't perfect. And for sure, I think Zuckerberg is right when he's saying that they were censoring more than they actually should. But of course, there was a choice there to improve these filters, to make them more sensitive. And the choice was really to just like stop using them, right, for most of the cases. Then there's, of course, the question on what's the role of regulation in such context. And I think this is the question that European legislators, for example, are grappling with, and many of the legislators in many of the countries are grappling with right now. When you see the space of self-regulation shrinking, in a way, there's a question of what will occupy that space, if anything will occupy that space.
Yeah, and then since we are aware that this is a very pessimistic and like too much negative information, we also wanted to show good examples or like practices that are working. So we encourage you also to like see this in a positive note. We can do something about it probably if we unite the forces. So one example is this initiative is funded by public funds, by the Home Affairs, I think, in the United Kingdom. And it's originally launched by the Revenge Porn Helpline, which has this name that I said we shouldn't use, but they still have it. And they are collaborating with many of these big tech companies, right? And their success rate of removal of content takedown is 90%. So this is a good example that things, when platforms also collaborate and join this shared databases where they create these unique hashes for identifying pictures, and then when this picture is about to be uploaded in another platform, it's automatically identified before it's on the online world, are working, or at least are working better than other initiatives we're doing. So this is a good example of collaboration between public and private institutions that is working quite well, we could say. Then an example from the Spanish Data Protection Authority. They have a specific channel. It's called Canal Prioritario, which means priority channel, let's say, to deal with violent content and this non-consensual content. It's a good initiative that the Data Protection Authority has launched this type of public policy. The problem we see, again, refers back to this definition, right? They use such a narrow definition of violence that most of the daily cases of online gender-based violence don't fall within their scope or what they consider they should intervene. And then their success rate is quite limited for this. And then also because they don't collaborate, at least yet, with technological platforms. So the real means that they have are not so many. Like, they use the appeal mechanism by platforms, and if they cannot get the content deleted like that, they just refer them to the judicial procedure. But at least it's a good initiative, also seeing it from a different angle, right, from the data protection perspective. And I will let Mariana explain this example.
Yeah, this is a project that this organization that I'm one of the directors of in Brazil, Internet Lab, develops in partnership with other organizations. That's an observatory of online gender-based violence during elections. And what it does is gathering the data from different social media platforms on what candidates, the kind of interaction that happens with candidates and male and female candidates to be able to compare. And I'm not sure how much that should be part of like the positive notes, because actually the conclusions are pretty lame. But I think it's good that we have such initiatives, that we're able to have such initiatives. And actually, our work has been made like a lot harder lately because of how most of the social media platforms have made access to their APIs almost impossible, especially for an organization in Brazil. So let's see how that develops also after the obligations of the DSA and if that's going to be applied locally or globally. But this is a project that has inspired many political candidates to go out and speak about this or sue some of the aggressors. We had very positive feedback from important and also smaller politicians in the country saying that they had no idea that this was so prevalent before seeing this project. So I think projects to like make this kind of violence visible are very important because of this, because otherwise it just keeps being like an intuition that that people have, especially the people who are going through this and think that they just have to have a thick skin and go through it because it's just politics. And when you look into the data, you really see like the differences that exist when you're talking about a woman, when you're talking about a black woman in Brazil. And this is just two references. This is a first a book that I published a year and a half ago in Portuguese. I'm working on the translation to English right now, which speaks about developments in the past 12 years in the field of policy on online misogyny. And some of the research that I have referred to and other studies as well, I worked in this report that I wrote for CIGIN, which they're analyzing Ipsos research in 18 countries on online gender-based violence, and I was analyzing the data about Brazil comparatively. So this is references. And we thank you very much.
We do have time for one or two short questions. The microphone is over there.
Hi, thank you. I have a question regarding the DSA, or multiple questions actually. could you elaborate a bit more, for example, the law regarding gender discrimination you showed? Is it like, does it apply on content that is misogynist, or does there need to be a particular interaction between two people that one, like, yeah, let's call it hate speech or whatever, or does it also apply on like on the logos you showed, the platforms I use, basically all of them, on them I saw misogynist content recently, so. And the second question, has there already been some cases regarding this?
So cases, the commission has started some enforcement or like some investigations, but cases per se, no, because this entered into force last 2024 February for all platforms and for big platforms September 2023, I think. So there has been no time. And as you can see, they are still seeing how this law will actually be applied. It was a very innovative law, and we, like, no one really knows how are we gonna like tackle all of that. I think not even the people from the commission know how to handle the information they will receive and how they will receive it and which type. One example is this templates I showed. They were released like 6 months ago, and platforms have to do these transparency reports every 6 months or every year, depending on their size. So we haven't seen the new report, but I was checking the previous reports just to see, and it was true that many platforms just provide the bare minimum information, at least before this report, that it was actually, at least from a researcher perspective, not meaningful. So we will also, that's why I'm a bit concerned that maybe this transparency, I'm of course in favor of transparency, but maybe We won't have so many means to actually know what's going on, and like they will disclose the minimum information. But there's an interesting tool called DSA Transparency Database. If you just type that on Google, you will for sure find it. And there, platforms are forced also to submit all the content moderation decisions that they do in the European Union. And at least there you can see the type, you can filter, and you can filter by different type of content, illegal content, incompatible to the terms of use. You can also filter by gender content, or like non-consensual or pornographic, or like animal welfare, many things. And this is an interesting source of information. But again, we're only seeing the content that is moderated or being reported as moderated, but we don't know what happens in reality in the platform and what happens with other things like shadow banning or the content that just stays online. So, and I think it's a tricky moment right now, because since these regulations are so new that they didn't even enter into force and were like well established, and now we had this US change, we will see if this will, at the end, at some point we were talking about the DSA having a Brussels effect on the US, but now I think we're no longer thinking that. Like we think maybe the US will now have an influence on how this law will actually be enforced. So it's to be seen. So I hope I replied to your question. Yeah.
I have one question. Do you see a correlation between countries which have a stronger regulation and less online gender-based violence? Or is it too early to say?
Countries which have a stronger?
Also, those who have a stronger regulation?
Regulation.
Do they have less online-based gender violence, or is this unclear?
I don't know any data comparing this, like more regulation and less online gender-based violence. Do you?
I mean, for my experience and the data you showed, Europe had less in theory rate. And I know we are leading a bit the effort on criminalizing things. But again, it's the issue of maybe criminalizing things doesn't mean better enforcement or better like connection to victims offline being their rights guaranteed, right? So I don't know.
Data, right?
Yeah.
The problem about this is that it doesn't try to find the roots, right? Yeah. It could as well be a lot of culture, like different cultures, different relationships, like gender norms in the different countries. More inequalities leading to more violence as well. So this study didn't really find the causalities, and I've never seen a study directly establishing causality, especially because many different countries have many rules for, especially for criminalizing, right? What I have seen are studies showing that prevalence of violence didn't decrease after criminalizing. But that's also in criminology studies really hard to assert, especially because there's a very high rate of non-reporting, right? And that's very high, especially in gender-related crimes, sexual-related crimes, like the cipher that's called like the gray cipher, right? That's a cipher of people who never show up to a police station to complain about anything is really, really high. I think that would even be interesting to see if it's different when it comes to the reporting to the platforms, because reporting is usually very high. It's usually what the victim wants, right? Like having the content taken down. Really finding the correlation between more regulation and less violence, I've never seen.
Spain, they actually modified the criminal procedure law so that judges could issue like these orders for platforms to act fast, because the problem they were having is that survivors really did not, I mean, of course they cared about the judicial procedure, but when you're suffering from non-consensual image abuse, what you want is the images to be deleted. So you want the fastest solution. And if the judicial procedure will take like 1 year and a half, either the perpetrator can have deleted all by 1 year and a half, or the harm is already so big that it's like almost useless to do. So that's one of the problems, that we need like also public mechanisms maybe to take down this content faster than following the traditional criminal procedure.
Yeah. Great. Short question. Perfectly fast for us. I'm sure there will be around.
Yes.
So how do you see the role of the employer, like the organization I would work for, the university I would research for, if I publish and put myself out there as an expert and I get harassed or whatever for that? Is there, like, are there things moving that I would get psychological support or even legal support or something?
Very good question. I can start. I see that these questions, particularly online gender-based violence, they're not very much addressed. I can see some initiatives looking at violence, especially for scholars who are at risk, but they generally don't address the gender issue, and that's really a problem. So, for example, there's this network, Scholars at Risk, that looks at, that tries to protect scholars who in like vulnerable situations, and the data doesn't really, like, the data that they release doesn't really break anything by gender, or there doesn't seem to be a particular, like, concern on gender. But more broadly, if we look at employers, I don't think many are approving policies for this, or that employment law is looking at this in particular. I don't know if you have other...
Yeah, I think they might have something for, like, cyber mobbing or something, but usually it's not breaking down on gender, in my experience as well.
Okay, thank you very much again.